Welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is honored to have with us author Erin Bartles, whose new book is The Lady with Dark Hair. Before we begin, I'd like to let those tuning in know the Poison Pen does have copies of the book on order, and we would be happy to hold one for you or put one in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to our web store at the Poison Pen Bookstore. Now I'd like to welcome Erin Bartles.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you for joining us today. My first question for you, as a reader, I'm fascinated by how you got to where you're at today. So what can you tell us about Erin before you became a published author?
Well, I've been very involved in publishing for a very long time. I've worked for a publisher since 2002. And before that, I was an English major. So it was kind of inevitable that eventually I would write and publish my own books. So what's nice about working for a publisher is that it becomes something that feels a lot more accessible than when you're an English major and you're reading mostly dead white males who seem a little bit different than regular people, when in reality, writers are all just regular people.
So working in publishing encouraged you. I would think seeing all those rejections, that would discourage you.
No, actually, I feel like it felt far more accessible once I realized when I saw behind the curtain of, you know, what people were sending in that still needed work. I'm like, well, come on. If these people are doing this, then I certainly can. And it was just a matter of waiting to the point when I felt like I had something worth saying. It was one of those things where I always felt I would write, and I wanted to write when I was in my 20s, but it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I really started working on novel length manuscripts. And I just didn't have anything interesting to say in my 20s. Lots of people do, but I didn't.
And what was that path to publication like initially?
It was slower than I thought it would be because I was always, quote unquote, a good writer. And so I think when you go through life as a good writer and you definitely know what stories work for you, but you don't necessarily know how to create those. So there's a difference between being a good writer and a good storyteller. And that was the learning curve. So I believe I started working on a novel length work in maybe 2010. And that eventually became my drawer novel that I didn't really, you know, do anything with, but I tried to do stuff with it. I'm really glad it didn't fly because, you know, it wasn't ready. And that's what the reactions from agents were. It was that, you know, you have great writing, there's great scenes, but this isn't quite it. So I just kept working. And I think I started researching what became my debut novel in 2013. And then it came out in 2019. So it was kind of a long road. But I think it was a necessary one.
That's interesting. Which brings us to your novel that just came out this month, The Lady with Dark Hair. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a dual timeline story. So there's a past timeline that happens starting in the 1870s, and it begins in southern France. And it talks quite a bit about artists and the Impressionist movement and the changes in the art scene through the eyes of this orphan, basically, from Catalonia, who has sort of fled her home country for various reasons that are explained in the book, and is working in the house of an artist, and falls into this life of being a model and then an artist herself. And that feeds into the present day story, which is about a woman who, with her mother, runs a small, sort of obscure museum about an ancestor of theirs who was a painter. And there is some question about what she considers his greatest work, which is the portrait where the title comes from, The Lady with the Dark Hair. And as these two stories unfold, you kind of see the truth about that and the truth about her ancestor. And it talks a lot about issues of creativity and sort of restrictions placed on women in the past, and then this kind of internal restrictions we place on ourselves in the present.
It's a fascinating book, and you really capture kind of the artistic process. It reminded me a little bit of The Girl with the Pearl Earring by Tracy Chevalier, and
okay.
How you're able to see the the way artists create what comes to be their later work. You're also a creative person, and I just wondered, after reading that, all this interest in art and things like that, you actually kind of are an artist yourself. Is that correct?
I've been artistic my whole life, and I certainly love creating art. I do paint. I paint oils mostly lately, watercolors, and I do things like sewing and quilting, and I've done mosaics, and I just really like to make physical, interesting looking things. And I think it's a really great break from the sort of cerebral work of writing and sitting in front of a laptop. And I really enjoy it. And that fed into this book, certainly, because during the year that I was doing most of the writing of this book, I was also deciding I'd like to learn how to paint portraits, because I would normally just paint landscapes and things like that. And so I every month of 2022, I painted a self-portrait as I was trying to get better at people. And so that was really fun, often frustrating, but overall a very fun process.
Did that kind would was there any connection between what you were doing and what Esther's mother, Lorena, was doing with her self-portraits?
Yeah, so I don't remember. I feel like I decided that Lorena was going to do that before I started doing that. It's hard to remember timelines when it comes to what you're creating. But yeah, so she is somebody who has had this lifelong project going where she does a self-portrait each year, and she's recording the aging process. And she also suffers from schizophrenia, and so she's recording herself in this kind of desire to show people who she really is, and show herself, I guess, that she's a permanent thing. There's something about her that's not going to kind of go away at some point, because she does have this sort of this issue, and the medications that you use to treat schizophrenia often kind of remove affect from people, where you get kind of more of a blank sort of feeling. And so she's working through that through portraiture. And I just thought it was such an interesting idea to have a house that was covered with pictures of the same person. Now, my self-portraits, I'm raffling off at the launch event for this book, because there's no
Oh,
reason for me to have that many pictures of myself in the house.
what a wonderfully inventive idea. You write with a great deal of depth and sensitivity, and there was one thing that you had, I actually had to write it down because I thought it was so profound in a way. It was Esther talking to her mother, and what you wrote is, "Why do you continue to paint yourself each year if you don't like the way you look?" Esther asked. Her mother was quiet for a moment, and then she was quiet for a long time. Esther feared she had hurt her feelings. Finally, she answered, "I want to be seen." A pause. "Even if it's just me who sees me." I thought, wow, that's really says so much in so few words.
Yeah, I think that's something that I don't know if a lot of people feel that, but I feel like everyone wants to be seen and known in a certain way, but we're all kind of afraid of being seen and known too, honestly. So even though in Lorena's case it's related to her illness, I think that there's some truth in that, especially, I don't know about for men, but I think especially for women, that you're looked at and you need to appear a certain way, especially now that everyone's on social media, and you're looking for the best angle and the best lighting, and well, let's put a filter on that. And I think there's just a lot of feeling of you want to be seen and noticed, but only in the way that you're comfortable with. And it's sometimes hard to know even what that is for oneself.
It's true. You also really capture in a very nuanced way the relationship between mother and daughter, Esther and Lorena. And what I thought was interesting for Esther feels like she has to take care of Lorena. I mean, she's pretty much put her whole life on hold or pause or denied it just because she feels she has to be responsible. And yet she learns later in the book, and this is true, I think, in many cases for people who are caregivers or working with someone who has an illness or some type of disability, that the person doesn't want to always be taken care of. It's a very thoughtful look at that relationship.
Well, thank you. And I feel like as I age and my parents age, you just start thinking about those things of, at some point, how involved am I going to be in this person's life? And I'm a pastor's wife, and so I see that in a lot of people's families where they are taking care of people who used to take care of them. And it's a real strange change in roles. So it's something that's interest it's definitely something that interests me recently as my parents start to get into their late 70s and yeah, it's definitely something that a lot of people go through and have to navigate.
And the need to be seen also plays on a broader scale in your book when it relates to women in the art world. And you give some examples. Well, I guess they're characters woven into the story of real artists, Berthe Morisot and Mary Cassatt and Rosa
Bonheur.
Bonheur.
Yes, and Marie Braquemont, which most people have never heard of, I don't think.
And you kind of show how each woman is trying to be seen in the art world, but in a different way.
The really interesting thing about women in the arts is, well, there's a couple things. First, obviously they're models for centuries and centuries before they're really allowed to do much work of their own. And even when they are able to find a way to learn, because they were usually excluded from the academies and from schools. They were excluded from life drawing classes because, heaven forbid, they see, a man's body, even though men are looking at their bodies all the time. So they had to be creative about finding ways to learn the craft. And they also had to be careful when they were trying to practice the craft. There are a lot of women artists who didn't sign their work because that was considered too proud, or else they had to hide the fact that they were the one who did that. And there are just a lot of women artists whose work has been attributed to other people over the years. And those are more and more in our day being rediscovered. And it's really exciting. I read a great book when I was working on my book, called The Mirror and the Palette by Jennifer Higge. And I highly recommend that to anyone who is interested in the story of women artists, because it's 500 centuries of women artists that most of them you haven't heard of, but they were out there creating and trying to be seen in a serious light as someone who was doing good work and doing work on their own terms.
The book also has a lot of information, especially in the historical context, about the art world. And you've talked about one source that you've used, but what did you discover that fascinated you? Because for me personally, I never knew, maybe I knew and forgot or whatever, but that the paint was actually such a big part. There were people that sold it, and you had to find these ingredients, and it was like you just didn't go into your local supply store and buy
Right.
a tube of vermilion or something like that.
Right. Yes. And I think one of the reasons you have such a different movement in art during the late 1800s is because of these technological changes. So in the past, somebody would sell you pigments, and as an artist, you would mix those yourself with whatever medium you were using. If it was egg whites for tempura or oil for oils, or sometimes people would mix it with glue. Which is called distemper, I believe, which is funny because it's also a disease in dogs. But in the late 1800s, you had this innovation of these tin tubes that you could just sell paint in tin tubes. And that's why you see so many people then leaving the studio and painting in plein air. And you have this movement of the Impressionists painting light and painting people in their natural habitat, and not painting biblical or mythological epics, sort of thing. So that was one thing that's very interesting. And just the history of pigments alone is fascinating to me. And I have a couple books I can recommend on that as well. Maybe you can put them in the notes or whatever. But the other thing that I found very interesting when I was researching the Impressionist painters was that everyone hated their work when it first came out. Almost exclusively bad reviews. And some of them were just scathing. I have a great book that has a lot of the actual reviews in newspapers and journals of the first exhibitions of Impressionist work, and they were just really not holding back at how awful they thought it was. And today you see it everywhere, and everybody says they love it, and it's on posters, and it's in dorm rooms, and wherever. But it's funny, when people are doing something different, you're going to have people who automatically dislike it. And but it's the things that are different that kind of change those paradigms and make those shifts where something new and exciting is happening, and you can express yourself in a different way.
That's terrific. I have to ask, Mummy Brown, that's a pigment. Did it actually have ground up mummies in it?
Yes, that is why it
Oh my
was called
God.
Mummy Brown, because it was the color of actual mummified remains. And lots of mummies were removed from graves and sold as a way to make a pigment. Yeah, pigments come from all sorts of interesting places, crushed up insects, seashells, rocks, all sorts of things.
Wow. Let's talk about your writing processes in general a little bit. You've also written something that I thought was interesting. You said fiction should tell the truth, but it should not tell it directly. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think that I think that what I mean by that is that fiction should ask questions honestly and leave a reader to come up with what they believe is the answer. So I don't like prescriptive fiction that tells you what to think about X, Y, or Z. I really love fiction that asks questions that maybe we're afraid to voice. And the things that maybe we'd be embarrassed to say, yeah, I've thought that. Or I hadn't been able to put words to my feeling about this thing, but this book helped me do it. And so I think that what's important in fiction to me is to represent people as they are, not as they ought to be. But still maintaining a feeling that people can change. There's redemption, there's forgiveness, and there's hope.
That's fascinating. I think that also plays into something that I think you kind of illustrate with your books. And you're published by an inspirational press, by a
Yes.
faith-based fiction publisher. But I think for people who don't read that type of fiction, there's often the misperception it all comes in one flavor, and it doesn't.
Yes, but it's not an unearned stereotype, because for a long time it really did only come in that flavor. I think more and more you see people writing in ways where you have different types of plots, different types of characters, more expansive view of humanity, and yet not losing this underlying worldview that believes that things can be different.
That's
Yeah.
good. Yeah. I mean, I really loved your book, and there is a lot of elements to it, but it's also something that's very accessible to someone who may not want to read what they think is a 300-page lecture or
Right.
something.
No, it's definitely not that. That is the key, I think, when you're researching is I like to do a chunk of research first. So I'm researching the next thing I'm writing now, and I've been reading for over a year. I'll write a lot of notes and then I'll forget a lot of that. But it's all kind of background. And it's not that on the page I want to prove to you that I know about this thing. It's what is it that colors this world and makes it feel real?
That's interesting because you also had written something that I thought was interesting. It applies to historical fiction, but to fiction in general. You said the key to writing good historical fiction is to remember that history is not dates and wars and amendments and cultural movements, it's people. And I think that is
Yeah.
really, it's your characters.
I wrote that.
Yes, you did.
How wise of me.
Yes. You wrote it and forgot it.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and I think that's true. And I think that probably people would like history class more if it were taught that way. I've always found I was a history minor, so I'm interested in history anyway. But I was always irritated when I was learning something in isolation because it didn't make sense. I'm sorry, World War I could not possibly have started because one guy got shot. There's more to the story. And if you actually read about that time period, you see all of the reasons and it all makes sense. And I had a great class in college called Classical World. It was a 12 credit class, it was over 2 semesters, and it was the Roman and Greek worlds, but it wasn't just history, it was history, art, theater, poetry, warfare, you know, all of the things, and everything made sense. And I feel like if we taught history that way, with personalities at the center of it, and didn't teach it in isolation from other things, then people would probably enjoy learning it a lot more.
It's true. As far as your writing process itself goes, I'm guessing you have to fit this in between other duties, or how do you approach writing projects? Do you have a goal? Do you work each day on a certain number, or is it more you just find the time?
I wish that I was one of those people who woke up at 5 and started writing and got 2 hours done before anybody else got up. I really, really want to be that person, but I really am not. My husband is an insomniac, so I often don't get great sleep. I'm not waking up early if I don't have to. And so I usually will let all of life kind of go to shambles when I'm drafting something, because I'm trying to do it as much in one chunk as possible. So I have usually started at the beginning of the year, taking the first week at least off. When everybody else has gone back to work after Christmas and New Year's, I take that first week off, and I usually am ready at that point to start drafting something. And I've drafted an entire book in 2 months, and then it's also taken more than a year. But my preference is to find lots of time in one group. So I take vacation to write. I don't go places very much, but I have a lot of vacation because I've been at the same company for a really long time. So I can use those as, all right, I'm going for a long weekend to a hotel, and all I'm doing is writing, or people will be out of the house, and so all I'm doing is writing. And I just kind of fit it in. Yeah. Cause I have a 9-to-5 job and, you know, lots of other responsibilities, raising kids and things like that. So yeah, everybody's busy.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also important what you said, because a lot of people think there's one way to write a book, and you have to find the way that works for you.
Yeah, you really do. And I think that's true of almost any rule in writing, that there's a way that maybe is a great suggestion for you if you hadn't thought of it, but it's not the only way.
Let's talk a little bit about you as a reader, because on your website, you had a fascinating essay post, I'm not sure what to call it, about your relationship with books that shaped you as a reader and a writer. And I thought that was really quite lovely. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I just decided one day that a bio is one thing, but who I became as a writer is more than just like, well, here's one person or two people that influenced me. And I have a really hard time when people say, what's the one book that changed your life? Or what's your favorite book? I don't know. I really can't tell. It's always an accumulation of things. So as a kid, you know, I read a lot of the things that all kids read. And a lot of those that I chose myself turned out to be kind of dark. There's a lot of death in them, and overcoming situations that you didn't choose. And I think it's because I lived such a very easy, normal life. I was attracted to more exciting lives in books. But yeah, I think the combination of those types of books as a kid, especially books that had strong female protagonists, like Island of the Blue Dolphins or A Wrinkle in Time, things like that, where you have to figure out how to do things without adults. I always thought that that was a fun way to read as a kid. But my most read book as a child and as an adult still is Watership Down. Yeah. And I always adored that book. I spent a lot of time as a kid pretending to be an animal, so that might have been part of it. But even as an adult, I can really appreciate, you know, the kind of story it is. I really liked stories where people had to move on from something in whatever way. Like, you can't change the past. And I think a lot of my writing has to do with that. This idea that you have to go from where you are. You can whine and moan about what happened to you, but that's not really going to help you or anybody. What do you do now? What do you do with your accumulated experiences, good or bad? And how are you going to live a good life? And how are you going to help other people and be a good example to others? So And beyond that, I just really liked remembering the books that I read that I loved.
Is there anything recently that you've read that you wanted to share with others or that you found interesting?
Like I said, the past year I've only been reading for research, so I don't think I'm going to share any of those. But a couple other books that I read while I was writing this book, The Lady with the Dark Hair, one of them is called The Secret Lives of Color, and it's by Cassia St. Clair. You know that book? I love that book. It's a very highly designed book. It's really great for dipping in and out of, and because the entries are only 2, 3, 4 pages, but it explains where our colors came from, like where and when certain pigments were discovered or developed, and how that changed art, fashion, home decor, things like that. And even how it factored into world history, because people were looking for, it wasn't just trying to find gold in, the Americas. People were looking for a source of red. And I love, love, love that book. So that's a really fun book. And another one that I read was called Color, A Natural History of the Palette. And that's by Victoria Finlay. And that's more of a memoir where she's going to all of these places that have these kind of legends of this is where that color came from, visiting saffron fields and mines and all of these things. And sometimes she finds what she's looking for, sometimes she doesn't, but you learn a lot about the area and the culture that that color came from. So that was really fun too.
Both are great suggestions. In addition to everything you do, you also write poetry. Is that true?
Occasionally.
Okay.
I'm not a constant poet. I'm a poet when the seasons change. I feel kind of itchy and like wanting to be, poetic. So I tend to write during times of transition.
Is that a different writer's skill set between prose and poetry, or?
I would say absolutely. And I also in the past few years have taken up songwriting, which is similar to poetry. Although slightly different, I guess. I feel like poetry is great for those kind of flashes of a particular thing, a particular feeling, a particular problem that I'm not going to spend a whole novel talking about this one thing, but this one thing's really interesting to me. And so that's what I like to put into poetry. And I love reading poetry too. I like finding new modern poets, but also reading poetry that, you read in school and trying to appreciate it more as an adult than you did as a student in high school. There's a lot of that that they teach you in high school where if you reread it as an adult, you're like, oh, this is actually really good. I just didn't have the life experience to care when I was in high school.
I think you're right. A lot of times, books, whether they're poetry or prose, sometimes you have to go back to them at a different point in life and you see something different, usually.
Yeah, and you understand why people think it's a big deal.
Or in some cases, you never really like the book at all, and you
That's
just
true.
reinforces your opinion.
And I'll tell you, my one of those, which I've tried really hard to like, is Catcher in the Rye, which everybody loves,
No, I
but I
hated
get
it.
so angry every time I read that book.
I would agree with you. I don't think it's, well, for me personally, I didn't get it. And then I don't know if you know, but there was a book and a movie called My Salinger Year, which was
Yes,
an
I
editorial.
watched that.
And I'm thinking, okay, it's just me. There's thousands of other people that seem to, and that's okay. You don't have to love every book or every author,
And
but
I think
I
it's important
understand.
to be able to admit what you don't like and say, it's fine. I was a kid who obeyed rules, so automatically I'm like, Holden Caulfield is a bad kid. And you know what? He's the biggest hypocrite and phony of them all. And I stand by that.
I think you're right, but we may be in the minority. My next question you can answer or not, depending, because I know for some authors it's something they like to keep close to themselves. Can you tell us what's next for you?
I can tell you a bit about what's next. I can't tell you the actual subject. So the book that we're talking about today is a dual timeline, and my debut was a dual timeline. Actually, it was three timelines. And then in between, it was mostly contemporary. But I'm going to go full historical on the next book, and it's going to be about real people and real events, which is why I don't want to tell people about it, because you know how every once in a while, two or three books will come out or two
The
movies
same
will come out
time,
and it's about the
yes.
exact same thing. And I don't want it to get out in the ether where
Yes.
it can like grow legs and go away from me. So I've been keeping it quite close to the vest, but it's set in Europe somewhere. I can tell you that. And I'm really excited about writing it. It's going to be different from my other books, because when you're dealing with real people, you have to deal with who they really were, and you can't force an arc on them, a character arc. So it's going to have to be honest about these people, which means it'll be with a different publisher probably than my previous books.
That's fascinating. And I'm guessing that the best way people can find out when the book will be available is through your social media. What social media sites are you on?
Sure, I'm on Instagram and Facebook. I'm also, you can find me at aaronbartles.com, and all of the links are there. You can get sign up for my newsletter. And if people are writers and they're listening to this, I started a Substack just for writers called Experimental Wolves. So you can look for that.
Oh, that's great. This is the quickest time has ever flown by. We've been very fortunate to have with us today Erin Bartles talking about her new book, The Lady with Dark Hair. It's a wonderful book. She has a wonderful backlist of titles for you to explore. I'd like to thank Erin for taking time to share her thoughts with us today.
Well,
And
I
for
really
those.
appreciate that. It's been really fun. You asked a lot of good questions.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for all of you tuning in for another episode of Author Chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. We hope to see you virtually next time. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.